Hello and welcome to episode 218 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual from different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of your Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S-E-A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the S-E-A.
You know, occasionally you see exciting things on Instagram. And I think this was last Friday. We were tagged in the comments of an IG post by Third Pelton brother Tyler Gardner, the man behind The Listener Drinks Along. And Fremont came out with what I think might be the most us-targeted beer that has ever been made.
Wow. The most us-targeted beer.
Until someone releases the Boulevard Park-themed Rainier beer or something like that. The Super Bowl 48 champion Rainier beer, we'll say. This is the Birra de Fremonti Italian-style Pilsner from Fremont Brewing.
Are we, like, that notably known for liking Italian beer?
We're that notably known
for liking...
It's
not a thing that's really come up on the Pelton Cast before.
No, but we're noted for liking the Italian soccer team.
Well, I mean, we really like the Italian beer, too. But it's just not, like... I don't think anybody would have ever described that as like a defining characteristic of the Pelton Cast.
That's fair. What do you think is a more Pelton Cast targeted beer, I guess, would be my question.
A more Pelton Cast targeted beer.
Yeah.
That is an interesting question. I feel like it would have to be like a craft brewery partnering with Rainier Beer. Which happened, right?
It did happen, yes.
With Rubens partnering with Rainier. So that's something where that's like, that's a pretty Pelton Cast beer. Here's one, though, if you want me to throw it out there. A Loretta's beer.
Oh, wow.
If Loretta's partnered with Rainier to not do a different recipe, because that's the issue. We only want Rainier to taste like Rainier. But they did Loretta's themed cans of Rainier. That would be the most Pelton Cast beer ever. Thank you.
But anyways, this was an exciting beer when we were talking about it in our group chat.
As promoted by Jermaine Kearse.
Yes. The famous cousin Katie weighed in that she wanted a 4-pack of these from Fremont. So we got 3 different 4-packs of these.
All of the Carcinos.
Yes, absolutely. I'm still a Carcino. It's still my middle name. A little bit about this. The Bohemian Pilsner malt and wheat with Hallertauer, Spalter, and Saphir hops. And aroma of florals, lemongrass, and other grassy notes, cereals, lemon, herbaceous, spicy aromas, and honey. The flavor is slightly sweet with a modern bitterness with a light, crisp body.
Now, I think somebody pointed this out on Instagram, but these are maybe the most sleek-looking Fremont cans ever.
They are stylish.
The design, which I can see sort of the Italian inspiration. It almost looks German to me. but it's definitely got sort of like, I want to say like a prog rock-inspired can.
I don't know if that's what I was getting from this.
There's a designer who does a bunch of rock posters that does posters very similar to this for sort of like cool internet-y bands. And I was like, oh yeah, that's the Birra de Fremonti can. It does not look like a Moretti or a Peroni in the can, though.
That is definitely true. Which are the two Italian beer makers that we get at stateside. All right, well, we got a few toasts here to get to.
Sorry, I just drank some. It's excellent, by the way.
First off, to Third Pelton brother Jamal Crawford, signed by the Brooklyn Nets as a substitute player last week because like half of their roster is out after testing positive for COVID-19.
We want all Third Pelton brothers to get signed during this time period. We're looking for Jamal Crawford, Rashard Lewis, Katie.
Percy Hawkins.
Yeah. Everybody who could, J.J. Redick, everybody who could possibly be signed, who is a third Pelton brother, needs to be back in the league during this time period.
Sue Bird?
That'd be huge. That would be really big for the Pelton cast.
Bad news for the Storm. It would be if an NBA team signed Sam. She went from one bubble to another. We're also pouring one out this week for the logo, Key Arena logo / name removed from what will be Climate Pledge Arena last week. A full decade after KeyBank last paid for sponsorship. They
got their money worth. Does KeyBank still exists, right?
KeyBank does still exist. Okay. Our mom was talking to me earlier about the interest rates at KeyBank.
Oh, God, of course. Fun conversation.
Yeah. She's chatting is what does. They still exist, but just probably did not see a lot of value in continuing the Key Arena sponsorship once it no longer had a marquee winter tenant. And from the city of Seattle standpoint, it was too expensive for them to change, more expensive for them to change the signage, so than to like get a new sponsor. So Key Arena it was.
You talked about this online last week a little bit, but Key Arena is definitely up there if of the corporately branded sports arena names.
Yeah, I think like, Danny Kelly mentioned that. I would think I was replying to his tweet.
It's just a tasteful name for an arena. You don't, and also KeyBank, there's something to not being that big of a brand where it's not like when what? I hear the word key, I don't immediately think of KeyBank, right? Well, like
when you hear the word climate pledge, do you immediately think of Amazon?
No, but that's, it is pointing to a specific thing, you know? It's pointing to some stupid bullshit thing. But I'm saying this isn't Quicken Loans Arena, right?
Qualcomm, to me, is always like near the bottom of this list. Also, the Jazz have had some pretty terrible arena names. Energy Solutions Arena.
That is currently terrible. I'm sure when it's called Energy Solutions Arena, they just call it something else.
It's tougher because, like, if it's a place that's always had corporate sponsorship, because, like, we can continue to call Heck Ed Heck Ed.
It's fucking Heck Ed.
With all due respect to our friends at Alaska Airlines, but it's just going to be Heck Ed always.
Yeah. So, but I think that's why Key Arena is such a good name. Like, you could hear that name and not even know the brand, and it would sound good. But, like, T-Mobile Park... You only know, like, you have to say the entire name of the brand in it, and there's no other T-Mobile.
I mean, I think it's two things. Number one, it's a corporate name that is a word that has a normal meaning. Like, T-Mobile doesn't mean anything outside of the company T-Mobile, although mobile obviously does. But
that's what I'm saying, yes.
Key is just like, yeah, it lent itself to a lot of puns. Our fans are the key, etc. But also the fact that it wasn't KeyBank Arena.
Only you would factor that in as a positive.
Oh, look, I had to write a lot of posts about games at Key Arena. You don't think I'm going to need some puns now and again? I mean, we talked about this when the arena
closed. I take it all back.
I spent a lot of time there. But also the fact that it was Key Arena and not KeyBank Arena.
I'm actually pro Energy Solutions Arena now after that statement.
Let me tell you, first off, you can make puns with energy as well.
Oh, God.
I just wait with what we'll come up with Climate Pledge.
Anyway, RIP to the key.
It was definitely like a little emotional. I mean, obviously the arena itself, everything under the roof doesn't exist, but as long as those signs stood, there was still a link to the past incarnation.
There was something so incredible about Key Arena that, of course, ultimately made it not viable for an NBA team to be playing in that made it such a good viewing experience. And all around, that experience of being in that stadium will forever be synonymous with both the Sonics and with our childhood. And no matter what happens after this, there could be good times. It will never feel the same.
And with the Storm, like throw that in there too. All right, next up on our toasts, to former Husky football coach Chris Peterson, named Fritzky Endowed Chair in Leadership at UW's Foster School of Business for the 2020-21 academic year. This is a position that the Foster School of Business uses to bring in typically people, obviously, from the business world, but to speak about their experience in leadership and you know, share what they've learned, their advice. And if you're going to have a coach do that, it's going to have to be a coach named Pete from the Seattle area.
There you go.
So it's kind of what Chris Peterson talked about wanting to do in terms of, you know, highlighting some of his other interests when he announced that he was stepping down as UW football coach.
Our he may be the only person from the UW coaching staff last season who actually will be working this year.
Well, we'll see on that one. On a similar topic, get well soon to Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott, who tested positive for COVID-19 last week. All right, and then this also isn't a really a toast, but
a toast to ourselves.
Yes. To remembering the Let's Remember Some Years podcast. If you were looking to just listen to those portions and catch up, if you missed any of them, we have now split those out as their own feed. They are available as a podcast on Spotify and iTunes, as well as on the sonicscentral.com/PeltonCast site as well, if you want to stream them from there, all the way from 1993 through 2015.
Did you ever make theme music for Let's Remember Some Years?
I didn't, but I had to make a logo to post it on there. It was a very terrible logo made in in MS Paint.
Oh, yeah, it was. Isn't that how the PeltonCast logo is made also?
I think one incarnation of the PeltonCast logo may have been made in MS Paint, yes. The current one was
baseball
made.
Cards as, of us as children?
No, of so many of those. So many of those. The current incarnation was made using, of course, the free trial of Photoshop.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah. shots of the free trial of Photoshop.
Love that free trial.
And then again, as always now, for Breonna Taylor, Elijah McClain, Andres Guardado, Manuel Ellis, and any other victims of police brutality out there.
Toast to them. Do you want to talk about Seattle food?
Do I want to talk about Seattle food?
Well, I gotta ask.
You don't even have to ask.
So
you had me at Seattle food.
That's true. So I had a bit of a Seattle food and drink adventure today. As we record this, sadly, no longer the case as you listen to this, unless I guess you do it very quickly after it gets posted. It is National Mac and Cheese Day. A toast to that. And to celebrate, our friends at Beecher's put out one time only, one day limited release, mac and cheese sandwich.
So this is the first time ever.
I don't know if they've done it in the past. This is the first time I've seen it.
I was under the impression that this was just like one day a year they do this.
That was my guess as well, to celebrate this. So given our fondness for Beecher's mac and cheese, and particularly for anything with mac and cheese, Beecher's mac and cheese, world's best mac and cheese, is an ingredient in it. This was a must to go get. Sadly, did not want to book a flight out of SeaTac, so decided to go down to Pike Place Market. And while I was there, also wanted to get some Rachel's ginger beer, get some growler fills there, so can do some delicious Moscow mules, since that's my cocktail of choice when drinking at home. And then decided to complete the lunch to head over to Meesim Pastry and get a humbao. So there you go.
And that's not everything. You also, down there, went to Cloudburst Brewery. You had, for real, Glenn Christie's trip to Seattle and all the eating that he did compact into one trip to Pike Place Market. You went to all the places.
He still ate a lot more than I did. It wasn't even that notably large of a lunch, as it turned out. But also,
shouts to Glenn Christie.
Always.
You have a package on the way to you from Big Scary Monsters.
Nice. Cloudburst, yeah, was on the walk back to my car where I parked. So I was like, well, I can't not do this now because I don't go anywhere. I don't go.
I felt kind of judged when I threw it out there as a like, you should go to Cloudburst. You basically were just like, why the fuck would I do that? And I was like, okay, sorry. Jeez.
Yeah. I thought better of it. I was just frazzled as I was waiting for those mac and cheese sandwiches. There was a lot of people around. So I don't go anywhere that often now.
When you're frazzled, you start criticizing my suggestions of Cloudburst Brewery.
It usually doesn't take me being frazzled to criticize your decisions.
Suggestions.
Either.
Oh my god.
So I don't go anywhere right now all that often, but I especially don't go to Pike Place Market in the best of circumstances very often. So, you know, I wanted to get my money's worth out of the trip down there. That was my logic.
I mean, you for sure did.
Yeah. Packed a lot into my 35 minutes around there. I guess it might have been 45, I guess, all told. So the mac and cheese sandwich, first off. Whenever we're going to make sure to highlight this, if we ever see it pop up again, you got to go try it. It is amazing.
Okay. Let me just say something here. First off, I fully agree. I don't question whether it's amazing or not. That is, it was up there with one of the best sandwiches that I've had all year.
Yep.
But here's the thing. And I don't mean to diminish the sandwich that we just had, but you could go to Beecher's any day and get a cheese sandwich and get the mac and cheese, open it up, put the mac and cheese inside, smoosh it together, have a delicious mac and cheese sandwich, and have extra mac and cheese on the side. This is what we should be doing every time we go to Beecher's. This is a sneak, people.
My mind has been blown. I had never even really considered it, to be honest.
You didn't consider it until I just said this?
No. I mean,
it's just the two ingredients. They don't have that many foods on the menu.
It's like when we thought that there was going to be the little Woody's next to the Beecher's in the airport, and you were going to be able to create your own mac and cheeseburger, world famous mac and cheeseburger. But I think there is an
element. You have to go to two locations for that. This, you just get two items from the same location.
Well, they would have been right next to each other in that world where little
even
Woody's
still, this is. Even easier. This is maybe the easiest sneak that we have ever come up with.
It is true. I definitely going to try it. I feel like there was something, some sort of alchemy in actually cooking the mac and cheese with the other cheese and the bread and just having all of that be gooey together. But I certainly want to give it a
try. It's not going to be as good as it was today. But is it going to be 85%?
Maybe.
And 85% of a mac and cheese sandwich is 100% better than mac and cheese or a cheese sandwich.
It's a compelling argument. Mac and grilled cheese, someone called it.
It's just the perfect sandwich.
It really is.
So you had never had bao before this, or at least miso bao, is that correct?
I've had more than my share of bao. Good sir.
Okay, I was kind of confused because Katie also was like, is it a donut? And I was like, what the hell is wrong with you people?
I don't spend very much time at the market, so I've never
probably had
miso.
20 plus of miso baos.
It is huge bao. It is definitely much bigger than any other bao I've ever had.
You said you were let down by it. That's the thing that was really surprising to me. I think maybe it's because you didn't know what you were getting going in.
No, I mean, I knew what I was getting going in. I just like I was searching for it to try to explain this to a friend that I was texting about it. And it's like people refer to this as one of the defining foods of the city of Seattle. That to me is a little overhyped.
I don't know if I disagree with that. I disagree with you, but I don't know if I disagree that it's one of the defining foods of the city of Seattle.
I got that you disagreed with it.
Of course. You get the sort of like gooey outside bread and then the soft inside and then the pork in the middle. Like, these were maybe a little bit drier than previous ones, but I also had it after, you know, 40 minutes or so.
Correct.
So because if we're trying to figure out what to name your delivery service,
oh no,
when you go get food and then I pick it up from you,
what we name it is the "I'm making it convenient for me, not convenient for you."
We're at Kevin Hub right now. We'll see. We'll see where we end up. There has to be something more clever.
Yeah, there's definitely a downside to it. But you
is
had
there
the Mac
a downside
and...
to it?
No, me delivering things to you.
But I'm going to your house and picking it up.
Yeah. No, the downside is for you. It's not for
me.
Oh,
no. But you still do the work of going to the place. All I have to do is drive to your house, which is relatively easy.
Right.
Like, this, it's really the perfect setup for all parties involved.
We're splitting the drive in half, basically.
this is podcast commuting, which we could talk about a lot.
It seems like we might have to split the commute in half another time. Because there's another specialty food item that we're going to have to try out here. Newly posted on Instagram on Tuesday night, a new sandwich alert with our Peltoncast emergency sirens from Unita Burger. The pork bosom sandwich is here in a riff off Chef David Chang's version at Momofuku in New York. Sweet and savory pulled pork, kimchi slaw, pickled scallion relish, and bosom sauce on a traditional bun. Order one online on our website. Hashtag ugly delicious.
They, you know, we named them Seattle's best burger, and then we took it away from it, from them.
It was,
and they're trying
personal
to get it back again.
It was nothing personal. It was nothing Unita didn't do. That is a strong play towards reclaiming that title. Although I guess that's probably more of a technically a sandwich than a burger.
I also just want to call it, I'm just like going to Unita Burger on Instagram to read about it again. This is an unofficial partnership, right?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that, I don't think they reached out to David Chang.
It's just kind of interesting that they specifically called out. Oh, so do they have a pork bosom sandwich at Momofuku in New York only?
Possibly, yes.
Interesting. It was so weird when they did the hashtag ugly delicious, and I was like, wait, what? Okay. Oh my god, smash a like on Instagram there. I also just wanted to mention the guava ginger beer from Rachel's. I just made myself a Moscow mule with, and just incredible.
I went with the white peach, but yes, definitely agree.
Oh, is that the one that you got for me, was white peach?
No, that was the one I went with. I got the guava for you because that's what you
wanted. Okay, I got guava and you got white peach.
Yeah.
Just incredible for a mule. It's a lot of ginger beer to get through. And
I don't think it'll take that long, all things considered. I mean, it's like 5 Moscow mules, probably.
You think that's all?
Yeah. Maybe
see
6.
How long the podcast goes.
Oh, wow. Might be a really long podcast if you drink that many Moscow mules, as it turns out. Should we turn our attention to the search for Seattle's best teriyaki?
Absolutely, we should.
Okay, so first off, let's follow up on last week's teriyaki poll, because the listener responded. This might have gotten the most votes of any Peltoncast poll we've ever done, I would actually say. It's plausible.
Really?
About whether you eat teriyaki in the restaurant or not. And it turns out that I'm definitely in the minority. Because
there we go.
4% of the listener always does so. 11% of the listener most of the time, which I thought was my vote, although I've got 43. I'm showing rarely, which was 43% of the vote is the vote. Oh, maybe that's just indicating the winner. I guess that's not my vote. And then 42% of the listener never eats teriyaki in a restaurant.
Thank you.
I don't know that this is like, I don't know that I was necessarily arguing that people do this. I'm just saying this was my experience. Also, Flint Pelton brother Ben Baldwin indicated that he is part of the always contingent here. Further indicating that Ben is more my brother than you are.
Wow.
Yeah. Said it.
Well, it turns out J.J. Redick is more my brother than you are, so.
is that a reference to him him shotgunning beer? Shotgunning a Bud Light?
It really is.
I was going to bring that up in the bubble talk, but this has become the fad of the NBA bubble is players shotgunning. First Jage and then Myers Leonard shotgunning a Coors Light.
Yeah, so he did it so naturally that it actually turns out that J.J. Redick is more my brother than you are. So, you know, we'll have competing podcasts. It's fine.
You know, competition will strengthen us. You got to always compete.
Mm-hmm. I'll be interviewing Zion Williamson, and you'll have Katie on.
That sounds about right. Ben's becoming a big deal, though. I mentioned this to him in our group DM, but I was on like a Discord community that had nothing to do with football necessarily, but there was a football an area for discussing football, and people were complaining about Ben on there.
I don't think you said that they were complaining about him.
I mean, I think it was implied. It was a Packers fan involved.
It was implied. You're like, he's becoming a big deal. I was on a separate community where somebody was complaining about him.
His national platform is growing, man.
Ben's, oh, my God. Wherever there's a Packers fan, there's somebody who both knows Ben and is mad at him.
Yes, that's absolutely true. What if Aaron Rodgers like actually mentioned Ben at some point during an interview? That would be the most amazing thing.
He can't acknowledge it. If he acknowledges it, that makes it too real.
It's like how Palm Springs could never mention Groundhog Day during the movie.
You worked in the first Palm Springs reference. I knew it was coming soon.
There you go. That was who had the over-under on that one? Okay, but none of this is our search for Seattle's best teriyaki, which continued this week at a location that comes to us recommended by an NBA head coach. Last week, I was interviewing Detroit Pistons head coach, former coach of the year, Dwayne Casey, longtime Sonics assistant coach and associate head coach, about some other topics. But because of some intel I had, which he refers to, there's a mutual friend who comes up, is the reason for this. I knew about his favorite teriyaki in Seattle and decided to check in with him about it. All right, I got one more last quick topic.
Okay, no, we can talk and talk all day, Kev. No, no problem.
I appreciate it. I really appreciate it. It's good stuff. The podcast I do with my brother about Seattle. Yeah. We look for Seattle's best type of various different foods, and right now that food is teriyaki. And I understand you have some thoughts on Seattle's best teriyaki.
Oh, I tell you what. How did you know that?
Well, I have a pretty good source.
No, okay. Well, I can't remember the name of the place, but we ordered teriyaki chicken. God, what's the name of that place?
Teriyaki bowl, I believe, right?
Is that what it is? Teriyaki bowl. You get stuff there for all of it all the time, but yeah, and during the summertime. How did you know that?
she listens to the pod, so we've talked about it. She swears by it, and then the Suns and you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So exactly. That's exactly where my goodness gracious. That threw me for a loop on that one. Yeah. We get that all the time. And I know Brent, we go and pick it up and I would say that's the best teriyaki chicken there in Seattle and enjoy it. Love it. But Seattle has so many different restaurants and great restaurants. And, you know, I anytime anyone's going through Seattle, I recommend the teriyaki bowl. I recommend Metropolitan Grill. There's so many Daniels. There's so many great restaurants that I used to go to and still go to there in the summertime. It's not even close. And the other best place you have to go to is Five Spot.
Yep.
There in Queen Anne. That is the best breakfast place in the country. And, you know, every time someone would come into town or we'd bring a free agent or draft choice in town, you'd get a breakfast up there at Five Spot and always recommend Five Spot to go there and eat. But teriyaki bowl, you threw me for a loop on that one. How in the hell? Because that was more recent. I didn't go to teriyaki bowl back when I was coaching and playing, but in recent, since I, you know, we go back in the summertime all the time. So, happy dog, kid. I mean, you did your homework, buddy. Happy dog, man. But we got to get a team back there in Seattle. Now, I don't know how we're going to do it, but we just got to.
Last week was the 12th anniversary of the move.
Oh my gosh, that's what's sickening to just think about, the team leaving the city and you know, it's just one of those things where you won't have a better city. Just mentioning all those restaurants and the communities and neighborhoods and just the passion people have for basketball. Now, what I found out, Kevin, when I go back home, I don't keep up with the NBA anymore. But yes, they do. Yeah, they do. They wouldn't take them 2 days until, if you put a team there, that they would be right back into the NBA and be passionate about it, you know. So that's the thing.
That was awesome. I mean, I guess, first off, yes, Dwayne Casey is right. Bring back the Sonics.
Yeah,
obviously. Right now. It's also very sad that we're sitting right here on the anniversary and there's still no team, but we'll see what happens in the next couple of years. And also, my favorite part about that is that the places that he mentions that he recommends are the Met, Daniel's Broiler, and teriyaki inside of a gas station.
It's not inside of a gas station. It's in the parking lot with a gas station. Also the Five Spot. Shout out the Five Spot.
I don't think I have ever, listening to that, I was like, I got to go to the Five Spot for breakfast.
Yeah.
I mean, not go to the Five Spot for breakfast, but get breakfast and then take it out.
It's not something one does anymore, but yeah, I miss the Five Spot.
What I didn't know, so they specifically have a very good breakfast there?
Yeah, that's what it's known for. They have like all day breakfast. We would go there for lunch at the Storm. This is more of a Storm thing than a Sonics thing. And it was like 75-25 whether I was going to order breakfast versus lunch when we went
there. I fucking love breakfast food.
Yeah, who does it?
God. It literally is the best meal of the day. Really no competition.
But that's not what we're going to discuss. We're going to discuss the teriyaki bowl, which, despite the fact that I worked in Furtado Center, where Case was previously as an assistant as part of the Sonics coaching staff, despite working there for like 6 months when the Storm moved in there after the Sonics moved to Oklahoma City, I had never been to Teriyaki Bowl, because when we were there, as I mentioned last week, instead we went to Yummy Teriyaki up the street.
I have to look where Teriyaki Bowl is, because I think it might be like a block from my office.
No, it's the other side. It's near 99.
Okay, so I've gotten gas at this particular Shell station.
You can identify the Shell station.
It's right about when you're about to get onto 99 going south.
Correct. Also by the Hampton Inn, where the Sonics used to put up players during training camp.
As everybody knows. The old training camp Hampton Inn.
Just dropping some inside info there.
I have never been to this particular teriyaki restaurant before this. And that's really, to me, the incredible thing about teriyaki in Seattle is that there can be a place that's a teriyaki restaurant just hidden away in the parking lot of a gas station. And the coach who should have coached the NBA champions last year, if he wouldn't have been wrongly fired, thinks it's the best teriyaki in Seattle.
Yep.
So, and you know what? He's not wrong. I'm not quite willing to go there, but I'm not going to say it's not Seattle's best teriyaki, because the experience of eating it was just like, I honestly have to say, after last week's teriyaki, this was refreshing. You know, there was something about it, especially getting the spicy too, where it was so flavorful. It was the right size of teriyaki. I just sat and ate the entire thing. I was sitting on my deck. It was sunny outside. I just had like one perfectly nice meal of teriyaki. It was hot, but it wasn't too hot. It was viscous, but it wasn't too viscous. It was really the perfect mix of everything that I could have possibly been looking for in a teriyaki.
Wow, there you go. I mean, to me, there's established a top echelon of the teriyaki that we've had so far. And Ichiro Teriyaki, which was my go-to lunch spot at the Storm in Magnolia, is in that group. Teriyaki Bowl is now in that group. I'm pretty sure you would put Yoshino in that group.
Absolutely, Yoshino is in that group.
And there's a place we're going to get to at some point, because we keep saying every week we're going to review it, and then it keeps not happening because Fremont keeps putting out great beer that I need to go get. And this was more convenient on my drive back.
How long are they going to have this Italian beer?
I don't know.
Pretty good.
So I think that's the top echelon so far.
And that's Teriyaki Madness that you're referring to, right?
It is Teriyaki Madness that is also in that group for me, because I had it back pre-pandemic and you never hadn't gotten to it. So we still needed to do it and review it, along with City Teriyaki, which I went to during quarantine, but you haven't been to yet. My ratings for Teriyaki Bowl, I gave the chicken an 8. I could have used a little bit more. I didn't mind the quantity, I will say, at I Love Teriyaki. The sauce, an 8, liked the spicy. The extras, 7.5, a strong 6 gyoza in my chicken and gyoza order.
Wow, yeah. 6 gyoza.
And then a 7 for value.
So these aren't incredible ratings to me.
But these are on the high side, especially because of the fact that chicken and sauce are the two heaviest weighted of these factors.
I thought, did you get the spicy or did you get the regular?
I did get the spicy.
Okay, because I thought the spice level was very nice on the spicy. And I haven't had a spicy chicken teriyaki for a long time, right? Like, it's been months since I've had a spicy chicken teriyaki.
And there was something about it.
I think that's probably true, which would have been mid to late February.
Yep.
Back before the virus. There was just something about having that. And really, I'm obviously not against having more teriyaki, but it was like I ate the entire thing and then I felt great after. I fucking ran a mile after. Like,
I don't know if I was going to run a mile after.
I felt very good about the whole experience. It was just like, this was such a pleasant experience of eating teriyaki, and this is what it should be, where you're just like, damn, that was a good meal, right? And then you just move on. That's like, that is the best teriyaki experience. It doesn't have to, like, it's not so rich that it has to sit with you for the next 8 hours after that, right? It's just like, that really just hit the spot. And I think that's really, like, encapsulates what is special about teriyaki in Seattle is this particular location.
Yeah. Again, like you mentioned, an unassuming location, to be sure. Doesn't look like much from the outside, but delivering high quality food inside, and that is the definition of Seattle teriyaki.
Before you move on, if you were moving on,
well,
there is something special about. There's something special about Dwayne Casey mentioning. You know, I joke about it, but like, there's a reason that he mentions and the Met and Daniel's Broiler, because it's like, here's your traditional like NBA style restaurants,
right?
But here is a Seattle thing that is not going to be in a place like that. It's not going to have $50 meals, but this is the peak of, even if this isn't Seattle's best teriyaki, this is the still the peak of what Seattle can offer with teriyaki.
So there's another teriyaki I have to review this week, and that is the teriyaki that I made at home last Saturday. I don't know. Again, Ben Baldwin showing.
I was going to say you and your brother both made teriyaki this last week.
His looked a lot fancier than mine, although the plating of mine with the chicken and the rice and a little bit of salad. I felt very good about that photo. It photographed extremely well. I ordered the chicken a 5.5. It was a little on the small portion side, as it turned out. And just not in. There was no char. That was the big thing. I don't have a grill.
Did you cook it? You don't have a grill at all.
Well, I cooked it on the old George Foreman grill because I was hoping to get a char off of that, but it really didn't.
It can never, ever be as good as real teriyaki.
Exactly.
Cooking on a George Foreman grill.
And then finished it in the sauce. I awarded the sauce a solid 7.5. It was a little, it was a little lacking in viscosity.
Oh. Low viscousness.
I assume it was low viscous. It could have been high viscous. I forget already. But it was a good flavor. I'm using the teriyaki glaze in the salt, fat, acid, heat cookbook, which they have for salmon, which I've done for salmon and has been really outstanding on that. But it's a nice balance, I think, of sweetness and a little.
Do you have that cookbook with you?
No, I borrowed it from the famous Cousin Katie last year, but I photographed some of the pages of the recipes I wanted to cook.
Is that unethical to just post a photo of that recipe?
We'll consider it. See if it exists online somewhere.
I think people would like to know where you're starting at, and also might like to try to recreate this themselves. Because I've heard through this process a lot of people making their own teriyakis.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not a difficult thing to do at home. The extras, I awarded it only a 2 here. The rice was bad. It was bad?
How did you make bad rice?
It's just not – I don't know. It was a little watery, and that thinned out the sauce further, which was not great. Also, wow. I had no gyoza, and I did not have the correct dressing for teriyaki dress salad. I just had to use some balsamic on there. But for value, I scored this a solid 10, as it is, in fact, quite cheap and easy to do at home.
I can't believe you rated your own teriyaki at the same scale.
It's good to have that as a comparison, as a control.
How much better, let's just say random neighborhood teriyaki, the place that's up the street in Boulevard Park?
I would say at least 15-20% better.
Theirs is 15-20% better than yours?
Yeah.
Okay. No. I would like to hope so, if that's what they specialize in versus you. I mean, I'm not going to lie. The salt, fat, acid, heat recipe is probably a very good recipe.
One would hope so.
Huh.
So we've decided not to do the top 5 songs of 2020 so far this week. You wanted another week to prepare your list. We're going to push that to next week. So let's get to sports.
Can we pause? Because I want to make another Moscow Mule.
All right, we can do that.
Should I do? Hold on. What do they call it with a rum Moscow Mule? Spiced Caribbean Mule? Huh. Or a rum mule? Jamaican Mule. That's what I was thinking. I was like, Jamaican or Cuban Mule? I was thinking about doing that. I also have whiskey to make a Kentucky Mule. I'm going to try one of those two. And we're back.
What do you got?
I'm going to call it a Cuban meal.
Okay.
Rum and Rachel's ginger beer. But a lot to get to with regards to sports this week.
We've got some actual games played by Seattle area teams, Puget Sound teams. We're going to start, though, with the NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci would be delicious in quarantine. And so would we.
What? You lost the plot on that one, I think. New Pagliacci seasonal's out. They've got a salumi meatball. seasonal.
Salumi meatball.
Yeah, salumi meatball.
Interesting.
Yeah, so definitely going to have to check that out at some point soon here, as well as the summer heirloom tomato as their other current seasonal. So the players are in the bubble. They are on the Walt ESPN Wide World of Sports complex at Disney World. And so far, the breakout star of the bubble, we mentioned shotgunning. That's one breakout star of the bubble.
Age breakout star.
The other breakout star of the bubble, UW alum Matisse Thybulle, who has been posting videos, a bubble life YouTube series that has been quite popular.
There we go. You think it's the breakout star?
I mean, who else would it be? It's been a week.
Pat Beverly was definitely trending there.
Yeah, but people know Pat Beverly more than they know Matisse Thybulle. Pat Beverly plays for like one of the three most likely teams to win the championship and is a veteran NBA player. Well, they're my pick for the championship. I can put it that way.
Can you describe to me these videos from Matisse? Because I have not watched any yet.
It is his life. The first one covers their arrival, their trip to Orlando, their arrival, and him just being alone in his hotel room before he passed out of the quarantine period. The second video, which was up on Tuesday, showed their first practice as a team.
Okay. I can't tell which part I'm more jealous of. The part of being all alone in a hotel room the part of being all alone in Orlando.
You know, it's not Charleston, but it'll do.
After being with 10 to 15 children every single day since March, you know, I'll take wherever. I'll go to Orlando all alone if I have to.
So we are, as this podcast comes out, a week away from NBA scrimmages.
Wow.
It's coming.
Sports are definitely coming a lot faster than you think they are.
They are. The NHL on deck, the NHL and the Players Association agreed on earlier this week on a return-to-play plan that also extends the CBA by four seasons through the 2025-26 campaign. That's important news for NHL Seattle, which faced the outside possibility of a work stoppage after their inaugural season in 2021-22. Baseball on tap to start at the end of next week. The Mariners are currently playing intra-squad games at T-Mobile Park.
What is opening day for baseball?
July 24th.
Man, 10 days away. It's just interesting because all of these sports are starting at the same time.
Yes,
basically.
That's what's unusual. It's usually you have the schedule. It's different sports at different times. Now, you know, obviously a couple of the sports were the soccer leagues were a little bit earlier in the U.S., but everyone else is going to be within a period of about a week here.
It's not particularly staggered. I think it's definitely going to take some getting used to, sports. So baseball is going to be still playing basically an everyday type situation, right?
Correct.
It's really interesting to see, like, if you watch SportsCenter, they'll have throwbacks or whatever to the greatest performances in home run derby history. And I'm like, this is not the home run derby time, even though it is. It's just like there's no – baseball hasn't been going on since April, so it doesn't feel like it's mid-July.
It feels a little more like it now that it's up in the high 70s.
Yes, finally now that it's hot, it feels a little bit more there. But it definitely, like, the points of summer not happening really make it feel like, of course, hydroplane racing is what I'm referring to.
I was going to say.
It doesn't feel like we are where we are in summer. You know, like, July 30th is definitely not when the NBA is supposed to be restarting playing regular season games.
It's supposed to be Seafair weekend, as it turns out.
There's a lot of cognitive dissonance happening with these things, because you emotionally feel these points in time for sports. Like, even if you're not if I'm not paying attention to baseball, but like last year it was like midsummer and I happened to end up at a bar or whatever watching the All-Star game, and I'm like, oh, the All-Star game's on, great. Like, I know when it is in the year, you know. And now it's just like everything is totally off.
That is true. You know what else is off? Seattle Sounders.
Oh, God.
A rough start in the MLS's back tournament.
Boy.
A scoreless draw last Friday in their opening match against the San Jose Earthquakes. After struggling in the first half, had the better of play in the late stages, but couldn't find finishing touch. While starting close to a first-choice 11 with newcomer Joao Paulo sitting out due to a quad strain, and Will Bruin is expected sideline. Joao Paulo also missed their second match on Tuesday morning, which came against the Chicago Fire, who the last time we podcasted were not in the Sounders group. They moved there after Nashville FC withdrew from the tournament after a number of positive COVID-19 tests from their roster. Bummer for that expansion franchise to not get to participate, but the two teams met for the second time this season. The Fire and Sounders played in the Sounders MLS opener way back in March at 6 a.m., replacing the scheduled match against FC Dallas, which also had to withdraw. The Fire got a 2-1 victory with all three goals coming after halftime. Chicago opened the scoring in the 52nd minute through Robert Berich, with Handwala Buana equalizing for the Sounders after a great run by Jordan Morris in the 77th minute, not long after I woke up and turned this match on. But 7 minutes later, the Fire got the winner from Mauricio Pineda off a corner kick.
And you woke up right before the Sounders scored a goal. I woke up right before the Chicago Fire scored a goal.
The first one or the second one?
The second one. And, well, I think I was maybe more reminded to turn it on. I was reading tweets. I saw a tweet, I think, from Stephen Cohen where he was like, Handwala, baby. And I was like, what? I was like, what's going on here? but I was like, oh, crap, this match is still happening. So I turn it on, and within 2 minutes of turning on the match, the Fire had scored that second goal. And really, the Sounders just don't look right. Everything about them is really just imprecise. Especially, you know, we've seen this team throughout the years struggle in the defensive back line, especially at various times last season. And it took them a while to get it together. And that was most certainly the case today.
It seemed like a deserved win for the Fire. They had the better of shot-based expected goals. Sounders actually had slightly better non-shot, which was a reverse of the opener, where the Sounders had better shot-based results, but San Jose really dominated possession and therefore had better non-shot expected goals.
Well, then watching, you know, usually when you see, and granted, the Fire were able to just basically stick everybody on defense at this point, but when a team is looking for a goal like that, usually you see a lot of pretty solid opportunities, and the Sounders had some to end the match, especially with 9 minutes of stoppage time. And there was really nothing that was particularly precise that happened. You know, this is what happens when you try to pick up a sport after not playing it for months. You know, they're not playing playoff matches after they've been playing together for 8 months prior. Right? Like, this is a rusty team playing at this point. And really, it felt like, you know, we were saying that this whole tournament feels like the World Cup. And it was a real homage to Italy in winning the World Cup and then being knocked out of the group stages for the next year.
At least the Sounders made it. They are still pretty likely to advance with their weakest opponent, a shorthanded Vancouver team, in the final match of group play. Could easily finish second with a win if the Fire beat San Jose, but need to dominate the Whitecaps, who have yet to play in Orlando. Their opening match was scheduled versus FC Dallas, so they'll play for the first time Wednesday against the Earthquakes.
Interesting.
The Sounders play Vancouver next Monday, but won't necessarily know where they finish because Chicago and San Jose don't play the final match in Group B until next Thursday.
Love it.
So, definitely some strange things to find. But, I mean, the other thing to mention on them looking out of sorts is also, you know, there is was mentioned on the ESPN broadcast, it was in the high 80s at 11 a.m.
Stephen Fry looked hot.
You know, like, that's a real reason for you to try to be on the front foot to take a lead and not be trying to come from behind in those situations, because it can be a lot tougher in those conditions.
So explain to me, I know it's complicated because Vancouver hasn't played a match, but the scenarios for the Sounders going into this third and final match of the group stage.
They're going to need a victory almost certainly. So, you know, the top two teams will automatically advance, and then the three best of the third place finishers, you know, is that right? Because the four best of the third place finishers across these six groups will also advance. So a pretty good shot again.
Okay. For
them to get through.
Well, especially as there become less teams playing.
yes. So we're down to 24 from the original 26.
Who knows what things may look like by next week.
Well, knock on wood, there have been a couple of isolated positive tests on other teams in the bubble, but we have not seen evidence of it spreading within teams the way that we saw with Dallas and Nashville yet.
Is their bubble similar to the NBA bubble where you really can't leave the bubble once you're in?
Yeah, the setup once you're there is similar. Now, the big difference is that MLS traveled there, you know, a minimum of, in the case of Toronto FC, which delayed its travel after some positives before they left, 5 days before they were scheduled to play their first match.
Interesting.
Whereas
okay.
In the NBA, the plan was we're not going to have any training in local markets. All the training camps will take place in Orlando, and that's what teams are doing now. So even if you did have some players that brought the virus into the bubble, which they had a couple of positive tests that they caught upon arrival, and those players never exited quarantine, but even if someone were to test positive now, it would be isolated within one team, you know, certainly, and then also they'd have still a couple weeks before they actually play a game.
But they're also no players are leaving the bubble.
No, in either one of these should you be. I mean, we saw a couple of NBA players put back into quarantine. Extended in the case of Bruno Caboclo, who left during the initial quarantine before getting the two negative tests that were required to leave. And then a new fresh 10-day quarantine for Rashawn Holmes, who accidentally left the campus for a food pickup. Well, better results for the Puget Sound's other soccer team, OL Reign. On Wednesday, Bethany Balser finally snapped their scoreless streak at 270-plus minutes with a stoppage-time winner against the Utah Royals.
There we go.
In that match, Balser's insertion is a sub had really unlocked the Reign offense, which dominated the final third of the game. And it was a clean sheet for goalkeeper Michelle Bedos, appearing in her first match since suffering an Achilles rupture last May. Another clean sheet kept by Bedos on Monday as the Reign drew the rival Portland Thorns 0-0, another scoreless draw. Many of those four Puget Sound teams in their final match of the preliminary round of the NWSL Challenge Cup. That match also saw the return of a couple players from injury. Sofia Huerta made her debut for the Reign as a starter, with Jess Fishlock, who hadn't played since suffering an ACL tear last June, coming in off the bench. That scoreless draw was to the benefit of the Reign, who finished in third place in the Challenge Cup standings and kept Portland in eighth place, last of the eight teams in Salt Lake City area and in the quarterfinals. So being third is big because the Reign ended up on the other side of the bracket from the dominant defending NWSL champion North Carolina Courage, who are the number one seed and the only team. They went 4-0 in preliminary play, and they are the only team with a positive goal differential in the Challenge Cup at plus six. Everybody else is even.
Break up the Courage.
Maybe should. So in the quarterfinals, the Reign will play Chicago Red Stars on Saturday at 7 p.m. Pacific time. One health-related question mark with those players coming back is Balser, who left the Portland match just before halftime due to an anxiety-related panic attack, something she also suffered in the 2019 playoffs. She was replaced by Taylor
Smith. And all of us have suffered through this time period.
Well, yes, many of us have. Taylor Smith, who gave the Reign more pace in the attack. So Reign looking competitive.
That's the most relatable thing you've said all podcast.
Rain looking competitive, but they're probably going to need more goals. A scoreless draw is not going to necessarily work in their favor now that we're moving on to the knockout stages of the NWSL Challenge Cup. Seattle Storm busy practicing right now in their bubble in Bradenton. They begin practice on Saturday after clearing quarantine, and you know, it continues to stand out as we see players on other teams not traveling with their team, whether it's due to positive tests or because of the fact that they're not going to participate. But the fact that all 12 Storm players we expected on the roster are there. Natasha Howard was the last one to clear quarantine for the Storm, but was part of practice on Tuesday, and they are gearing up. We also have now a schedule for the WNBA season, which kicks off on July 25th. The Storm will be part of the opening game of the season, taking on Sabrina Ionescu and the New York Liberty.
Wow, that's fun.
Yeah, so it'll be a match of Ionescu and Sue Bird, two star point guards at opposite stages of their career. They faced each other last fall when the U.S. women's national team played Oregon as part of their college tour and lost to the Ducks.
Well, and that'll be tough to watch because Capitol Block Party will be that night as well.
Well, fortunately, it's a 9 a.m. tip-off, so you'll be able to catch it before Block Party. That one's nationally televised on ESPN. The Storm, I think, part of the most nationally televised games. As, again, they've got all their stars, everybody coming back healthy, and a lot of other teams don't. The team we're watching right now is Washington, where Elena Deladon, it was reported on Monday, had her request for a medical exemption from the 2020 season denied, and she has not yet announced a decision on whether she will, in fact, play this season, the reigning WNBA MVP.
Denied by whom?
There's a panel of independent doctors that oversees those claims, which also her teammate in Washington, their newly acquired all-star, former MVP Tina Charles, also requested a medical exemption. We haven't heard back on that yet. So those two potential defections strengthening the Storm is the favorites going into this WNBA season. All right, UW football. I guess this is just UW General Athletic Department. The Pac-12 followed the lead of the Big Ten in moving to a conference-only schedule for most 2020 fall sports, assuming they do proceed as planned, including, of course, football. That means the cancellation of the long-awaited UW-Michigan season opener, which UW Athletic Director Jen Cohen indicated the two sides would try to reschedule, possibly for 2022 or 2023. As well as games against Sacramento State and Utah State. The one thing we haven't heard yet is whether conference games might move up to the start of September, therefore giving, you know, the Pac-12 either more time to space out the schedule or a chance to try to finish it before potential, you know, increasing cases in the winter.
Okay.
I mean, all
wouldn't,
this
wouldn't want an increase in cases in Western states, of course.
That sounds horrible.
Before the winter. Okay. So we don't really know what the implication of this is at this point, right?
I mean, we know what it means in terms of who UW isn't playing.
Sure, but like, there's a lot of unknowns that are coming out of this decision, which is, like you're saying, you don't know whether you're going to spread out the conference games, move them up.
Play more than nine is also another possibility. You know, you could do a true round robin and play all of the other 11 Pac-12 teams.
Do we feel like, I mean, I just, sure, but like, what's the difference? Why do you play non-conference games? Why do you not play non-conference games if you're just going to play just as many Pac-12 teams?
Well, I think the biggest reason is that way you could standardize the testing procedure, and that would be more difficult to do across conferences.
Standardized testing has always worked out great in the Pac-12.
There's also the possibility of moving the schedule to the spring. I mean, everything, I think, is still on the table at this point.
What do you feel like, knowing this information, where we are sitting here in mid-July, where the season hypothetically is six weeks away?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, these games are coming up soon, would be coming up soon. What do you think is the most likely outcome for these Pac-12 football games in the 2020 season?
I mean, to some extent, that requires expertise in epidemiology, so I kind of hate when these questions are asked, but like, what is my prior right now on the most likely outcome?
But just the way that you're viewing the situation, what do you expect? What do you think is the most likely outcome to happen? Not how is the virus going to evolve, because obviously nobody knows that, and I'd be pretty skeptical whether these universities are really trusting people with knowledge of epidemiology. But
I think they are. I mean, I think
it has been so difficult to predict, and it's different in each state, right? Like, we're talking about a state like Colorado, which is doing a very good job of minimizing the impact, and a state like Arizona, which is doing a very bad job. So these are both Pac-12 states, right? Like,
I mean, given that, like, obviously Arizona can't practice right now. Like, that's, you know, the Arizona schools can't. That's just not realistic. So given that, I think probably the most likely scenario is that we push back to the spring.
I really feel like we're getting a lot of steam for college football not happening in the fall.
It's going to be, I mean, and, you know, as bad as the situation is in Arizona and in Southern California, like, still in terms of the outbreaks on the actual athletic teams, way worse outside the Pac-12 than, you know, in the SEC and ACC in particular.
Absolutely. And, I mean, it's going to have to be a conversation. Like, the Pac-12 can't be like, well, we're playing in the spring, I don't know about y'all. You know, it requires a conversation between these conferences. And to me, the only way to approach this as even relatively safe for the players is to just shut it down at this point. Like, the idea of ramping up, you're talking hundreds of college football teams with up to hundreds of players on each team. It's just, the risk is so great for everybody involved that this is not, then the NFL is not really talking about going to a bubble, but even then.
But they have more resources in terms of testing. It's easier to be consistent with 32 teams in a centralized league structure than it is in college sports with all these different conferences and all these different teams. Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, the one good news on this front is that the UW Athletic Department last week announced no additional positive COVID-19 tests in the ongoing testing of players already on campus. So they have been able to facilitate a safe environment for players, which stands in direct contrast to a lot of other colleges.
So no UW players live in frats.
not at the current moment. It does not appear.
But no, I'm just not going into the situation expecting, and obviously there's not tons of time to figure out what's going to happen with the fall. There's tons of time to figure out what it looks like in the spring. And I think that is the best way to approach the situation, is maybe you do set it up in the spring with an all Pac-12 schedule. And that makes a lot of sense to me. From a football standpoint, however, what do you think this means for UW specifically?
Well, I think what it means for a lot of teams, if you move to this, I mean, we can analyze that if it happens, but obviously it would affect players.
I mean more for the NFL not draft. Playing Michigan.
Oh, not playing Michigan. I mean, I think it's ideal to not break in a new starting quarterback and a new head coach against Michigan. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, I think the first Pac-12 game is Oregon, right?
So that's
not any better if the schedule doesn't change.
Oh, God. They'll be breaking in a new quarterback as well.
Yes. But not a new head coach.
Had to be Oregon. I mean, Jimmy Lakes, he's been around the block.
Still, you know, it'd be nice to ease into it.
Yes. Well, who knows what the schedule would look like if there was a spring football season. But I'm approaching this assuming that college football is not happening. You're saying that the questions that remain are about the NFL?
Well, I think it's easier for the NFL to potentially do it than college football. It's much more realistic. But
what you were saying with the NFL draft.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, whether prospects will actually, like draft prospects will actually participate this season, especially if it's in the spring. There was a report that the NFL, that college football had, you know, kind of some leaders had gone to the NFL and asked them about moving back the NFL draft, and they were like, no, we're good.
We'll see.
We'll see on so many things.
We're good. Yeah, the draft will be when it's going to be, so figure it out.
We've already done one draft in quarantine. I'm going to do it twice.
I mean, it seems to me, though, if there were a late spring, early summer NFL draft, that means that it's more likely that they could have an in-person NFL draft.
Yes, definitely more plausible that way.
Like, I can see the positives for both of the parties involved, and they'll still could possibly own the time period. I don't know. The
NFL, I think it may be more about not wanting to commit to that at this point.
The NFL doesn't want these colleges to make the decision because of them.
No.
So, but ultimately they will. That doesn't really particularly worry me. I mean, there are going to be players who are not going to play, whether it's in the fall or whether it's in the spring. Rightfully so, in the same way that we've seen in basketball, in baseball, in not football yet specifically, but we definitely will see in football. There are going to be players who are going to make the decision that it's not worth it to play sports in the middle of a pandemic.
And your scholarship will continue to be honored even if you decide not to play. So that's, you know, there's not going to be that kind of pressure on players to participate.
And I mean, if you listen to the JJ Redick podcast, he talks about there's no 100% comfortability going into the bubble, but he's still doing it. And I think, you know, it's just a different scenario if you're a college athlete than if you're a paid professional athlete. You know, like if you're there, especially if you're a backup or somebody is on the fringe of the roster, maybe it's not worth the risk. You know, but if you're being paid hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, then you can kind of accept taking that risk. But, you know, I could see a number of players choosing not to play throughout college.
Yep. Let's wrap up with the Seahawks, who first off last week offered season ticket holders a refund for the 2020 season if they don't wish to wait and see whether any fans will be permitted for games. Have you come up with a decision here?
We're just on the chill plan.
Let it ride, see what happens.
I mean, we know what's going to happen. Like, there's not going to be fans in these football games, but it's like if there aren't fans, when there aren't fans, it just rolls over to the next season.
Right. An important update on Seahawks cornerback Quentin Dunbar. A search warrant obtained last week by the New York Daily News indicates that Miramar police believe that a friend of Dunbar and New York Giants cornerback DeAndre Baker oversaw payoffs to the four alleged victims of their armed robbery at the office of Dunbar's former attorney Michael Grieco. That would explain the change in story between the initial arrest and then the sworn affidavits presented by Grieco that indicated that, you know, their story's wrong and they were not the victims of this crime. According to the warrant, victims now have given sworn statements saying they were paid a total of $55,000 to recant sworn their initial statements. I do think it's important to note here, given some of the rhetoric in that New York Daily News piece, that, you know, one of the things we have to reckon with is in the wake of everything we've seen that's been reinforced, I guess, over the last 2 months is so often so much of the news reporting about alleged crimes is driven by the police because they're providing the, you know, seemingly objective report about things. And we've learned that those are not necessarily trustworthy or reliable reports.
I agree with you, but what do you mean by that specifically?
Just like, that it colors the reporting, the fact that you're getting most of the information from one side.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and we've seen over and over and over again throughout this time period that that side is generally untrustworthy.
It doesn't necessarily match up with, you know, when there's video, that sort of thing. Grieco did withdraw his co-counsel on Monday, said he didn't want to kind of distract from the case as it was going on. So Dunbar now has new representation as this case continues.
But when you read the story, do you feel like that's relevant for this story?
It seems like a reasonable... I mean, we haven't reviewed the Instagram DMs that were cited in this. Like, if they're legit, it looks very bad. I'm just saying, I don't think we need to rush to any judgment here.
I mean, I think this was Michael Sean Duggar of The Athletic who tweeted, I believe today, that he felt like Quinn Dunbar was one of the most exciting acquisitions that the Seahawks had all offseason. And now, in his perspective, the chances of him playing in the upcoming season seem very low.
That was based on analysis by their legal expert, Daniel Wallach. So, now, of course, the NFL does not have to wait for a conviction. You know, they don't have to let the justice system play out to potentially, put to preliminarily suspend him or make him ineligible.
No, they do not. We'll really see with this one.
We sure will.
But it is, I think we can approach the season saying it's obviously in question whether Quinn Dunbar will be able to play.
Sure. I mean, right now he's not eligible to travel to the state of Washington to participate in training camp. Now, he filed for that, I believe it was last week, and it was originally uncontested by the state, but that may change in the wake of the additional evidence that was uncovered.
We'll see how this plays out.
We also last week saw the debut of ESPN's 2020 position rankings.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Did we already congratulate Mina? Can we go back to that? Oh, Lord.
So to preview the 2000, here's the intro. To preview the 2000.
You know you work there, right?
We're going to talk about them in a fair and balanced fashion. We asked more than 50 league executives, coaches, scouts, and players to help us stack up the top 10 players at 11 different positions, starring special teamers. The results might surprise you. They surprised me, that being Jeremy Fowler, my ESPN insider colleague who is authoring the series. Here's how it worked. Voters gave their best top 10 to 15 players at a position. Then we compiled the results and ranked candidates based on number of top 10 votes, composite average, interviews, and research. We had several ties. We broke them by isolating the two-man matchup with additional voting and follow-up calls. Each section is packed with quotes and nuggets from the voters on every guy, even the honorable mention. The objective is to identify the best players right now for 2020. This is not a five-year projection or an achievement award. Who's the best today? Pretty simple. So this is similar to what Mike Sando, formerly of ESPN, now at The Athletic, had done with his QB tiers piece, with the notable difference that, they're not tiering these, that they're doing these, just in terms of rank order, a full top 10. And of course, they've extended it across position. But it's the same thing where, it's not the analysis of the writer. It's the analysis of the sources they're talking to. And it sort of reflects, I think it's valuable because it reflects NFL conventional wisdom.
Yes. Well, and that's why this doesn't necessarily, I think people almost blame the publication more than they blame who's actually doing the voting on this, which this isn't ESPN's NFL writers. This isn't ESPN's NFL statisticians. This is people working in front offices.
Believe me, I've been blamed for plenty of things I didn't write or wasn't responsible
for. Yes.
But it also makes sense because they're unnamed. They're not. They're anonymous as part of this. So the notable thing here, they have gone so far through 8 positions of the 11 they're doing. The Seahawks have one top 10 player in that.
Really? Game. I mean, yeah. They have one top 10 player at the most important position, and he's high in the top 10. So,
it's interesting because it works both directions. The fact that Russell Wilson is now getting so much credit from executives probably works to downgrade some of the other skill position players for the Seahawks, but at the same point, finally executives and these other people involved in this voting are realizing that, hey, Russell Wilson's really good at football.
Have they done middle linebacker, whatever they would.
They have not done off-ball linebacker. So Bobby Wagner, obviously Bobby Wagner will be in the top 10 there.
Is there anybody else on the Seahawks roster that you would consider a top 10 player at their position? Tyler Lockett, I suppose.
Yeah, so let's run through these a little. Russell Wilson was second among quarterbacks behind Patrick Mahomes.
We need to talk about the entire quarterback list in a second, but yes.
Getting votes as high. Did not get any first place votes, but a majority
just,
of the
just like we need to talk votes. About that MVP conversation too.
I guess so. His lowest vote was ninth. Chris Carson was an honorable mention at running back. Tyler Lockett was an honorable mention at wide receiver. Dwayne Brown was an honorable mention at tackle. And then the other player I think is a top 10 player at their position. I don't know if you want to say he's a Seahawk, but it's Jadeveon Clowney, who was also an honorable mention.
Well, and we've seen that he's been, you know, pretty notably undervalued this entire offseason. And we've talked about this pretty extensively, is that he doesn't have the sack numbers that line up with the pressure numbers. And it really feels like when we're talking about the, I mean, these are the people that are sending the contracts, right? Like,
yes,
the things that they care about are things that are quantifiable, and not quantifiable in the way that you and me think of quantifiable, quantifiable in the way that 1985 thinks of quantifiable, right? Like, right. Something that is easy to digest. This is not pressure rate, right? This is sacks and sacks only.
It's the classic, like, no, I don't care about stats. Stats can't tell me anything. So you're going by the eye test, but the eye test, it just happens to be exactly the same as points per game in basketball. That's weird. That's funny.
Yeah.
That's a stat.
The eye test matches up with whatever bullshit 80s stat you want to go by or whatever. If you can even really call them stats, you know, because that's not.
Well, they're stats. They're fit numbers. That criteria.
They're definitely numbers.
They're stats. Like, they're not analysis.
It just seems like objectively, or I guess subjectively, you and I know that Jadeveon Clowney is one of the 10 best rush ends in the game.
Yeah.
And we've seen it both backed up statistically and by the eye test and by him being the number one pick in the draft. But he doesn't have the sacks to go along with it, at least in this most recent season. Therefore, he's being undervalued.
Actually, did I say that Tyler Lockett was an honorable mention?
He wasn't even an honorable mention.
He was not an honorable mention.
I think Tyler Lockett, he's not. This is not true. But there's a chance he's possibly the most underrated player in all of football.
I mean, it's hard for me to say because I just don't have that great of grasp on NFL player value, and I just don't pay that close attention to
that's why I'm saying it's not true, because I know that there's somebody else who's more underrated. But, like, okay, how about this? Tyler Lockett is the most underrated skill position player in all of football.
It's probably true. I mean, he was fourth in Football Outsiders DR last year. He was number one among all wide receivers in 2018.
Think about that. He was fourth in DR, which is a counting stat, and he missed time for injury.
And he played on the Seahawks. I don't know if you're aware of this. They don't throw the ball as much as we would like.
Wow.
I mean, obviously people are giving Russell Wilson a lot of credit for this, and not wrongly so, but Tyler Lockett is at least a top 14 receiver in the NFL.
But also, like, Russell Wilson was worse when Tyler Lockett was injured.
That's an excellent point. Like, we haven't ever, you know, we've seen Russell Wilson play without Tyler Lockett, but he deserves some of the credit for Wilson's success. I just refuse to believe that Kenny Golladay is better than Tyler Lockett.
Kenny Golladay?
He was an honorable mention, yes.
They're really the Lions with the come up. Where are these wide receivers? Read me these wide receivers.
All right, Elijah. Golladay was solid top 10 by DR last year. I will give him that. All right, the list of wide receivers. Number one, Julio Jones. Number two, Michael Thomas. Number three, DeAndre Hopkins. Number four, Odell Beckham. Mm-hmm. Number five, Tyreek Hill, who, speaking of playing with good quarterbacks. Six, Mike Evans. Seven, Davante Adams.
Tyreek Hill was good Allen. Before he played with Pat Mahomes.
Nine, Chris Godwin. Number 10, Amari Cooper. And the honorable mentions were Stephon Diggs, Adam Thielen, Golladay, A.J. Green, and Cortland Sutton.
H. A. Green? I think the one that I take the most offense to is Beckham, I want to say.
Number four on the list is the least deserving to you?
Well, where did he wank? I mean, he's not... Well, I guess...
I mean, I'm sure it's been a while since Odell has been a top 10 receiver statistically.
Number 46 by DR. But, I mean, that's what they're judging. He was negative in DVOA last year. The point of this is to judge the most recent season.
No, the point is to judge the upcoming season, but it's also independent.
DK Metcalf was better than him by both statistical categories.
Independent of quarterback and scheme.
Are we say okay? Go through this list one more time, starting at Odell.
He's number four. Tyreek Hill is number five. Mike Evans is number six. Davante Adams is number seven. Keenan Allen is number eight. Chris Godwin is number nine. Amari Cooper is number 10.
Davante Adams, statistically, not terrible, but also, I just don't understand
quarterback.
What Tyler Lockett has to do, because he has counting stats. He's playing on a good team. He's playing with a good quarterback. Like, why does Chris Godwin get that respect, but Tyler Lockett doesn't? This is not to say that Chris Godwin isn't a good wide receiver. He finished second in DR last year, and number one in DVOA. But like, what is it about Chris Godwin, who's not a big name by any means, where you're like, yes, Chris Godwin, but no Tyler Lockett?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because scheme, obviously, you know, when there are two Tampa Bay receivers in the top six, it's partially talent, but scheme has to be part of that. I don't know. Yeah. I think Tyler Lockett is, I'm going back to this, the most underrated skill position player in the entire NFL. And I'll tell you, if we could look at the quarterback list, who I think might be number two.
Or his competition here.
And that's Kirk Cousins.
Oh, that was not who I was going with.
Who were you going with?
I think I was going Dak, but... number one is Patrick Mahomes.
At least Dak made the list.
Number two, Russell Wilson. Number three, Aaron Rodgers. Number four, Deshaun Watson. Number five, Drew Brees. Number six, reigning MVP Lamar Jackson. Number seven, Tom Brady. Number eight, Carson Wentz. Number nine, Dak Prescott. Number 10, Matthew Stafford.
The Stafford one. I mean, we've thought about Stafford before. Like
Matt Ryan not making the top 10 is also.
That to me, Cousins and Matty Ice are the two most shocking ones. I mean, Brady is one where you're like, you're saying that this is not about historical value, right? Correct. That is explicitly mentioned in here, but there is no way that these executives can separate Tom Brady's historical value from his current value, because as it is, Tom Brady is just, he is an average quarterback.
Someone ranked him number one among all quarterbacks.
That is insane. Like, that is, it's just, whomever did that has clearly not paid attention to football for four years.
Ranked him ahead of Patrick Mahomes. Someone ranked Carson Wentz number two.
They must have been confused about what they were ranking. If you were actually to look at this list and rank Tom Brady number one, you didn't know what you were ranking, right? Like, there's just no way that at 42 years old, you can say that Tom Brady is a more valuable quarterback or going to be a better quarterback than any of those other quarterbacks. Like, he's the one who probably should be out of the top 10. I mean, Tannehill has an argument to be in there. Cousins has an argument to be in there. Matty Ice has an argument to be in there. I don't think Rodgers is obviously massively overvalued. If he's on the list, fine. It's just like the whole list is just scattershot of quarterbacks outside of Mahomes and Russell Wilson, of course. Three through honorable mention could be ranked in any way to me.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go that far, but definitely those two have separated themselves at this point. And like, I was surprised, again, Lamar Jackson was so low, but Wilson also number two in Madden ratings being revealed on ESPN this week among quarterbacks with a 97 rating.
People have really, I feel like it's funny because we were so upset about Russ not getting respect early on in his career. And then
by early on in his career, you mean last year, correct?
Over time, I feel like this is the Rodgers effect. Like, the reality is, if Russell Wilson, I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, ever gets bad or whatever, ever becomes average, he's still going to be perceived as an elite level quarterback, because the way that you become good in the eyes of an executive, you're either Mahomes and it's unimpeachable. Right? Like, you just won the Super Bowl and you're clearly the best player on the team. Mahomes is far and away the most valuable player in the NFL. But beyond that, it is quality, and it is quality for a good chunk of time. And that's why Rodgers keeps popping up on these lists, because Rodgers was good 8 years ago. And that's why Dak will be, in 4 years, Dak will be up there where Wilson is, right? Like, it's so much about year after year after year of average or better seasons.
And I think Dak's going to have a hard time moving up.
Somehow that works against Matty Ice. I don't quite understand it. The respect for Deshaun is really interesting to me, too. Because I think Deshaun Watson is good, but he was number four, correct?
Yep.
It went Mahomes, Wilson, Breeze.
It went Mahomes, Wilson, Rodgers.
Oh, boy. I don't understand how you could rank Watson ahead of Lamar Jackson. Because, again, Lamar Jackson wasn't just good by one stat last year. He won the fucking MVP. But also, he was good by every quarterback stat. And he was better than Deshaun Watson by every quarterback stat. And Deshaun Watson doesn't have a decade of experience behind him, you know?
I generally like the Madden rankings better. They have Lamar number three, although they have Tom Brady number five.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's been an interesting wrinkle for this offseason, is the Brady bump. Because you would assume that people would have caught up with Brady, basically. I mean, he lost their first playoff game at home this year. But maybe this is like probably his last his last hurrah season, so we're going to give him the ranking for it. I don't know. I don't really know what to make of that. But
I mean, I think people think he's going to be very successful with the weapons in Tampa Bay, but then you're like, not.
Can he throw the ball? Brady will be worse than Jameis Winston was in Tampa Bay.
His deep passing was not as bad last season as it had been in the past, I don't think, if I recall correctly.
I am fully not convinced that Brady will be able to run that Tampa Bay offense.
Well, let's hope anyone gets to play.
They might be good. Also, Wentz. I will say that, too. The Carson Wentz respect is very baffling to me, because it seems like it's based on a half a season of greatness.
Before his injury?
Yeah. The pre-injury Wentz 3 seasons ago?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
It really is like, I mean, I'm looking at as ranked by DR, and I mean, Mahomes is not number one, but if I rank it by basically anything, it really is just scattershot. Like, all of these quarterbacks are totally jumbled, and it's kind of random how they have them ranked, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, but that goes to show that NFL executives might not be that great at valuing quarterbacks and understanding what to value and how to value players. You know, like, the reality is, if we're talking about Tom or Drew Brees for the upcoming season, like, I would obviously much rather have Brees than I would Brady. And it's like, is Brees being punished for being injured last year? But also, he played extremely well when he was playing, and he was number one in DVOA. Or, like, is he being punished because Teddy Bridgewater also wasn't bad when he was the quarterback of New Orleans? It is just the way that value is assigned in the NFL is so complicated, and who gets credit for things it's really based on almost randomness. And I think these lists end up just more frustrating than they are of any value whatsoever.
I mean, I think they're of value in terms of understanding why not to make an appeal to authority.
Why not to make an appeal to authority?
Yeah.
Or to have any sort of respect for authority whatsoever.
I mean, whatsoever is a very strong term, but
I suppose the argument here is that you can't just assume that because somebody is in a position of authority that they're able to view things more accurately than somebody on the outside. And coming back to your point about Ben being hated by every fan base or by the Packers fan base, it feels like there is part of that is people being like, well, you know, the executives know better. And I think the reality of seeing these rankings is the executives don't know better. And people who have never played football before, or who are just looking at spreadsheets and have never even seen a football game, could understand the sport better than somebody who has worked in football for 3 decades.
Yeah, I'm not willing to go that far. I mean, I think there is a need to understand the sport to
understand that Tyler Lockett is fucking good.
But to, like, there are some stats that, like, yeah, that probably is a fluke. And football understanding does help you in that analysis.
I suppose so. I mean, you could look at stats and understand repeated history, right? Like, okay, let's say you're judging Derek Carr, and Derek Carr had a better last season than he did the prior year. Maybe he was way down the previous year or whatever. Like, if you were judging it, you literally never seen a football game. This scenario.
I mean, I think of it more
you,
of like,
you would still value people who were good repeated years than had one good year and one bad year, probably more so than executives who are viewing the eye test would.
Sure, but I mean, particularly in the college level, like, where scheme is so much a part of it, of your success, having a football understanding is going to help you separate Cliff Kingsbury running Mike Leach's offense at Texas Tech from a legitimate NFL prospect.
But what are you saying? I mean, wasn't Pat Mahomes the quarterback at Texas Tech? Is he not a legitimate NFL prospect?
He was because he had different physical tools and was executing in a different way in the scheme. I mean, first off, the Texas Tech scheme was...
Who is that an indictment on? Cliff Kingsbury? Different. Players from Texas Tech? Mike Leach?
It's an indictment on just looking at stats. No, I don't buy that that's a legitimate method of analysis.
I'm talking about specifically within the NFL. Like, you have to weight things across the board when it comes to college, because obviously so many different college teams are running so many different schemes, but the NFL is a much smaller sample size.
It is.
We're not judging, or I don't mean it's a much smaller sample size. I mean that the level of competition is more equitable across the NFL. So if you're a quarterback who has a good
level
season
of talent
statistically,
is higher, so
you're probably a good quarterback.
But the level of talent is higher, so therefore scheme makes less of a difference. But I still think there's value to, like, and that's why Ben sits there and watches fucking Titans games from last season. Like, he believes in this too, my man.
I'm taking it to an extreme here, but I'm saying that
I don't believe in that.
If you were clear, I believe that.
How many Musk alveoles have you had?
Two. I paused the only time I refilled the Moscow Mule. If there were a person, I'm not saying that you shouldn't pay attention to the sport. I'm saying that you could make a logical argument that somebody who does not pay attention to the sport can assess quality among the players better than people who only are paying attention to the sport, but not paying attention to statistics. You don't agree with that?
No, I probably do agree with that.
I'm not saying it's like drastic one way or the other. You should only have one thing. But if I had to choose one, if you were like, give me one person to make my roster. I'm the owner of an NFL team. And you could give me a person who's never seen football before, but they have crunched every fucking number. Right? Or they're a statistician that is very good at understanding the sport. And we're ignoring all of the interpersonal stuff and the Sam Hinkie stuff. And you're saying
this is how the Dallas Mavericks paid a lot of money to Evan Eschmeyer.
Look, it could have worked out. some of us still believe in Eschmeyer. No, I'm saying apples to apples. If you give me both of these people, one is somebody who only pays attention to the eye test, and one is somebody who only pays attention to statistics. I am taking the statistics person 100 times out of 100.
I just don't even know why this is a relevant question, because it turns out you can get you a man who does both.
Who is that?
There's lots of
people. Run the fucking Baltimore Ravens? Because they're not in Seattle.
No.
You can find you a man who lucked into Russell Wilson. I actually don't know if you can find you a man who does both, because there are not that many out there.
I think that there are more of them all the time.
Well, let's hope so. Anyway, seeing this list, It illustrated the disconnect between these two conversations, I suppose is what I'm saying. The conversation that is happening on the internet around football and the conversation that is happening around front offices around football are different conversations.
Over a long enough time frame, they will converge.
Did you see, I think this was Nate Cohn, maybe it was Nate Silver, who is like, the thing that we've learned is that Twitter is not the Democratic electorate. And I was like, thank you. Did you see that tweet?
I did not see that
tweet. I was like, yes, that is the thing that we've learned.
I'm not sure all of us needed to learn that.
I needed to learn that through the primaries.
Okay.
Anyway. Oh. Well, we've reached the point that you're chatting the angry things, so on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.